Today on Annenberg Radio News.
Lots of smoke, lots of burning, buildings are on fire, lots of broken glass in the street.
We'll tell you what's happening with the fiery conflict in Ukraine. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, February 20th, 2014. I'm Bryony Ng. The two men behind the beating of Giants fan Brian Stowe pleaded guilty in a Los Angeles County courtroom today. Stowe was attacked in the Dodger Stadium parking lot in 2011 and was left disabled and brain damaged. Anna Sterling brings us the story.
Cretins, misfits, society's biggest nightmare. These were just some of the words family members and federal judge George Lamelli called Luis Sanchez and Marvin Norwood in court today. The two men pleaded guilty and showed a lack of emotion as they were sentenced. Judge Lamelli said he rarely comments on cases, but that this one screamed for it. He said the vicious attack in which the two men continued to beat an incapacitated Stowe proves that the attackers were cowards. Throughout his comments, Lamelli scolded Sanchez, the main aggressor behind the attack, for his apparent lack of remorse and what looked like smirking. 31-year-old Sanchez pleaded guilty to one count of mayhem. He was sentenced to 8 years in state prison. Norwood pleaded guilty to one count of assault. He was sentenced to 4 years in state prison. Michelle Hannessy, the prosecuting lawyer in the case, spoke outside the courtroom. She said the sentencing may provide at least one good thing for LA fans.
You know the problem we have, especially in the city and county of Los Angeles, with fan violence, but I think that if anything good has come out of this case, it brought public attention to the problem of fan violence at our stadiums, and hopefully people are becoming more aware of it and the stadiums are becoming more aggressive in the way they handle it.
Victim Brian Stowe's family gripped each other's arms as the judge read out the sentencing and gave emotional testimonies. Stowe's sister, Erin Collins, looked the men in the eyes, hoping to see some remorse. She asked, quote, "How can we even begin to consider forgiveness when you aren't even asking for it?" Another sister, Bonnie, said no sentence will ever be long enough for her brother's attackers. They will be released someday, but as she said, quote, "Brian's sentence is a lifetime." Stowe's injuries caused severe brain damage. He relies on the care of his family to perform basic functions like showering, dressing, and feeding himself. According to the prosecutor, his condition is not improving. In addition to the criminal case, Dodgers former owner Frank McCourt will face a civil suit for security negligence. Anna Sterling, Annenberg Radio News.
Mayor Eric Garcetti took a short ride on the Metro Gold Line today. The line will be connected by a 2-mile underground track to other commuter lines as part of the regional connector project. The goal of the project is to make it possible to travel from one corner of the region to the other without needing to make a transfer. Logan Healy rode along with the mayor to learn more.
Federal funding for the $1.4 billion regional connector project has come through after several years of negotiating. Construction is planned to begin later this year, and officials expect the project to be ready by 2020. Mayor Eric Garcetti, Senator Dianne Feinstein, two members of Congress, and other officials stood in front of a downtown Gold Line station and passing trains. They announced a new agreement that releases federal funds for the connector project. Garcetti praised the project as a step forward toward a fully connected transit system in L.A.
So you can go from Long Beach to Pasadena, you can go from the ocean to the east side without having to get up, switch. That means less time, that means more convenience, it means more people will ride and more cars will be taken off the road.
Therese McMillan of the Federal Transit Administration agreed.
It's going to make the existing transit that converges in downtown really link together and provide incredible travel efficiencies for the people of LA.
More than half of the project will be paid for by a public transit tax county voters passed in 2008, but grants and loans from the Federal Transit Administration will cover the rest. Garcetti said it's the first time in 17 years that LA has seen cash on the table from the federal government for public transit. Feinstein warned that budget cuts from the federal government sequester are making it more difficult for projects like the regional connector to get off the ground.
Other nations eat our lunch when it comes to building modern systems. So LA, I think, is in the vanguard in America of moving aggressively to build the system of the future.
Officials expect the Expo Line to connect with Santa Monica within 2 years. Garcetti said a train to LAX and a longer Wilshire line are also in the works. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
Traveling north to find you. Train wheels speeding, wind in my eyes.
Adjunct professors are protesting all over the country about not being paid enough. As a result, the Service Employees International Union is working to draw attention to its Adjunct Action campaign. As Sarah Zahedi reports, adjuncts at Loyola Marymount University are hoping to unionize.
About three-quarters of college instructors teach part-time. That's over 1 million teachers who make $27,000 or less per year on average. Most of these professors are adjuncts who are not eligible for tenure at colleges and universities. Thousands of these adjuncts are participating in SEIU's Adjunct Action Campaign. Emily Halleck has been working as an adjunct at LMU and UCLA since the fall of 2013. She is a leader in this campaign. While Halleck says she has had a positive experience as an adjunct, many of the adjuncts she knows are struggling. But Halleck says students can also suffer as a result of lacking adjunct benefits.
Students suffer in the lack of continuity from semester to semester. You don't know if the professor you have in the fall will still be there in the spring to write you a recommendation letter if you need. And you can't kind of build the mentoring relationships with students that used to characterize, you know, a quality undergraduate experience.
Administrators say hiring more adjuncts than full-time professors allows universities to save money, since full-time professors make $70,000 to $160,000 per year. That helps keep tuition prices low for students. But Halleck says the Adjunct Action Campaign is receiving support from many full-time tenured professors who want their adjunct colleagues to be able to share more work responsibilities.
Service and committee work that a tenured and tenure-track professor must do is something that adjuncts are not required to do and are not in many cases allowed to do.
LMU's administration is facing allegations that adjuncts are experiencing unfair labor practices. Because of this, LMU's adjuncts' attempts to unionize have been halted by the National Labor Relations Board until the allegations are resolved. While Halleck says many adjuncts are in support of unionizing, others might not want to speak out in fear of losing their jobs.
You're not going to want to make your situation even more precarious than you already feel it is when the administration has very publicly voiced their opposition to unionizing.
The National Labor Relations Board will investigate the allegations against LMU for the next 1 to 2 weeks. In the meantime, the Adjunct Action Campaign encourages adjuncts to keep talking to their colleagues and increase awareness of the issue. Sarah Zahedi, Annenberg Radio News.
An LA Unified School official told the Board of Education today that LAUSD schools are safe and well-maintained. The director of maintenance and operations told a committee the district is about done with the second phase of a school building survey. The results of the survey will help decide which buildings to fix first. The average age of school buildings in LA is 50 years. The district has been criticized for funding its iPad program with money voters approved to fund school construction. A group of teachers, parents, and students joined California's two largest teachers' unions today to tell their side of a landmark education case. Vergara versus California could dramatically change how teachers are fired and when they get tenure. Brianna Sachs reports.
Reformers that they're using our struggles to advance their
In a shady corner outside downtown LA's courthouse, a small group of teachers from California's two biggest teachers' unions line up to tell their side of the story. A landmark education case has been playing out in an LA courtroom for the past 2 weeks. Known as Vergara versus California, the case pits 9 California public school students against the state's education department. The students say teacher seniority and firing policies prevent them from having a quality education because their new, excited teachers are the first fired when budget cuts come down on public schools. But as California Federation of Teachers President Joshua Petchalt argues, it's way more complicated than that.
The millionaires and corporate interests behind this suit want to wipe out the basic due process rights for dismissing teachers. They are seeking to let go of experienced teachers for no apparent reason.
He's talking about Silicon Valley multimillionaire David Welch, who founded Students Matter and is sponsoring the students' case. The case highlights a deep-rooted division between reformers and teachers' unions. If the students win, five California laws could be drastically changed. Those laws decide how a teacher can be fired and how long they have to teach before they are protected by tenure. Teachers and their unions call the case
bogus. These folks want to see a series of reforms that blow up teacher protections and ultimately make teacher unions weak.
This just seems unbelievable.
That's Christine McLaughlin, one of the teachers accused of being ineffective by a student plaintiff, and she will be giving her testimony next week.
Very shocking to me to have this based on one student's feelings.
Teachers say they are scapegoats and that the reform groups are doing teachers and students an injustice. Manny Rivera from Students Matter staunchly disagrees.
We do believe the evidence has shown that our plaintiffs, as well as similarly situated students across California, are being harmed every day by these statutes that prevent districts and administrators from placing and from hiring and the most effective teachers.
His group says teachers' unions and the state are violating students' constitutional rights to a good education. So bottom line, this case raises tough questions. How do you have a system where teachers are protected from unwarranted dismissal, but let go when they fail? But then, how do you judge a teacher's effectiveness? Should there be tenure? Is this a civil rights issue? A labor rights issue? After listening to a long list of experts, parents, teachers, and administrators, the state superior court has to ultimately decide what it means to put students first. Brianna Sachs, Annenberg Radio News.
And now for the weather. Tonight it's going to be partly cloudy, with this pattern continuing tomorrow and temperatures reaching the high 70s. Over the weekend, it'll be slightly cooler but sunnier, with temperatures in the low 70s. Later on Annenberg Radio News, a family feud over the origins of a singing voice. Hundred people died today after protests resumed in Ukraine. Ella Banal reports on what's going on in Ukraine's capital.
Kiev is in chaos, again.
Lots of smoke, lots of burning, buildings are on fire, lots of broken glass in the street.
Michael Manley lives in Miami, and he has three cousins in Kiev. This morning, he talked to his cousin Victor, who has been protesting in the main square for the last 2 months.
He said that basically Kiev is in a state of shock right now. Basically, navigating throughout the city is almost impossible.
The government and opposition had agreed on a truce yesterday. But by this morning, protesters carrying clubs were fighting with police again, and reports say bullets rained down across the square. For the past year, Ukraine had been considering a trade agreement with Europe. But Russia threatened Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych with higher gas prices and trade sanctions if he agreed. The president turned down the trade late last year. Yesterday, ATVN spoke to Professor David LaFontaine, who was in Kiev when the anger erupted in November.
Ukraine right now is kind of split into two parts. There's the western part that wants to be part of Western Europe, and then the eastern and the southern part, they kind of want to go back to the good old days of the old Soviet Union when government took care of everything.
Meanwhile, Michael Manley and others with Ukrainian ties around the world are anxiously waiting to see what will happen next. And despite all the chaos, Manley says his family and many others aren't going anywhere.
Most people who are young and really care about the country, they are sticking around and they're holding their ground.
Today, the White House urged President Yanukovych to pull back his forces. But the administration hasn't said whether the United States will impose sanctions on Ukraine. Ella Bernal, Annenberg Radio News.
Federal judges have officially set a deadline for California to drastically reduce its prison population. The state has 2 years to enact its prison realignment program, but as Denise Guerra reports, prison reform advocates say there's no time to waste.
Signed into law by Governor Brown in 2011, the state's realignment program was designed to move low-level offenders from prisons to the supervision of local counties. At the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown LA, members of California's United for a Responsible Budget called on Assembly Speaker John Perez to act on reducing prison populations immediately, despite a 2-year extension given by the federal courts. Emily Harris is the group's outreach coordinator.
I think part of what we've seen, right, is the Southern California counties are the ones that are most responsible for locking up the most amount of California prisoners, especially Los Angeles is one of the worst counties. And so I think that we're especially wanting to make sure that people understand that folks in Southern California care and don't want California to be locking so many people up.
Prison realignment came as a result of the 2009 Supreme Court ruling that the level of overcrowding in California state prison was unconstitutional. Elliot Curry is a professor of criminology at UC Irvine.
Prisons that were just stacked with prisoners being, you know, piled on top of each other like cordwood, and very little happening in the prisons to ensure that they could reintegrate safely back into the communities. That this is a system that also was absurdly costly.
The recent release of the governor's budget reports an overall decline in state prison spending as a result of realignment. And though state prison populations have decreased, the program has overburdened the county's jails and resources.
And they're getting out and they're committing crimes as soon as they get out. You know, we hope that they're rehabilitated, but bottom line is, they're not.
That's Sergeant Robert Watt of the Torrance County Police Department, located at the southern tip of LA County. Supporters for realignment are looking for more state investment in rehabilitation programs as a solution to keep freed inmates from returning. Again, here's prison reform advocate Emily Harris.
We need to continue to be sort of in the legislators' faces saying, you know, stop locking so many people up. It's past time. So it's like they're talking about no early releases. And we're like, these are really long overdue releases. We lock up people for far too long.
Governor Brown has promised federal judges that the 2-year extension will be enough to reduce overcrowding in state prisons. And he has no choice. The deadline of February 28, 2016 is non-negotiable. Denise Guerra, Annenberg Radio News.
A smartphone application that most people download for free just brought in a lot of money. Jenna Pittaway brings us this story of a big purchase in the world of mobile technology.
I use it every day, maybe every couple hours even.
When you want to like communicate with a lot of people at the same time, it's pretty useful.
I just saw that Facebook spent a gazillion dollars for it and that their shares went down.
They're talking about WhatsApp, the latest mega purchase by Facebook. The social network paid $19 billion for the free texting app.
Texting is the most dominant type of communication. WhatsApp is that.
That's Robert Hernandez, a professor of digital journalism at the University of Southern California and a WhatsApp user.
$19 billion is not a small amount of money. I think it's the largest digital tech purchase.
The price tag is shocking, but law professor Michael Chaslow, who consults with startups at business clinics, says it might be worth it.
Facebook is used a lot in the U.S., but as I understand it, WhatsApp has a big presence overseas. And so a lot of times what you'll see is a big company looking for inroads into other markets. And so WhatsApp has these inroads into markets that are not traditional Facebook users.
Facebook has been on a buying spree, and WhatsApp is just the latest purchase. The company also purchased Instagram for $1 billion in 2012, and tried to buy Snapchat just last year. Jenna Pittaway, Annenberg Radio News.
It's only 3 days to go before the end of the Winter Olympics, and the U.S. is still just about at the top of the medals table. For the latest update, I spoke to USC journalism student Law Murray, who's been reporting from Sochi for the past 10 days.
Things are getting crispy down here. That's for sure.
So, Law, you're in Sochi right now and about to see a very exciting event. Can you talk us through it?
I am actually at the gold medal women's hockey game between Canada and the United States. Canada is the defending champion. It's really one of the better games that you can see.
You've got 3 days left of events to watch before the closing ceremony on Sunday. Who should we be watching out for in these last few days? Sorry to remind you of that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone in Russia will agree with me, but the men's hockey gold medal game, which has yet to be set, where we're not sure who's actually going to be there. You know who won't be, and that's Russia. That's going to be the highlight here. Personally, I'm going to be looking forward to the bobsled team. Steve Holcomb's four-man team is the only one left with a chance to win gold, both in 2010 and in 2014. We'll see if they can pull it off. Steve and his two-man team with Steve Langton has already accomplished something the U.S. hasn't accomplished in over 60 years, and that's win a medal in the two-man bobsled.
So the U.S. is topping the medals charts at the moment, with Russia and the Netherlands following close behind at the last count. Do you think they're going to beat the U.S.?
Well, you know, these hockey games kind of matter. We're coming down the last few days. Every event counts, and the United States has a good chance to hold on to that slim lead. But the Netherlands, I think, have a really good shot at could they come out of nowhere. And just on the strength of their speed skating ability, they might have a chance to be at the top of the medal count when this is all said and done.
Right. So it's going to be a close run thing then in the last few days.
Absolutely.
We've been hearing about the wider politics going on with Russia and the Ukraine, and also members of Pussy Riot demonstrating at Sochi. Has that influenced the games at all? Has it been quite apparent while you've been there what's been going on in the wider political arena?
There's been a bubble here. Games and events have gone on according to plan. I did hear today that the Ukraine team has been affected by the violence in their country, and I think it's been questionable whether or not they will choose to continue to participate while they're here. But right now, that's unfounded. The games have gone on.
Are you going to be going to the closing ceremony?
I certainly plan to. I think that there's more excitement surrounding the closing ceremony, and hopefully it goes off without a hitch. You couldn't exactly say that for the opening ceremony, so there's definitely a redeeming factor in the closing ceremony.
That was USC journalism student Law Murray reporting from the Winter Olympics in Sochi. Every family argues about something, but have you ever heard of parents battling over who passed on the best vocal genes? Eamon Oyubuke tells the story of how her passion for song turned into a home-brewed musical feud.
Take me to New York, I like to see LA. I really want to come kick it with you.
The first time I remember singing for the public was at 7 years old, during my aunt's wedding reception. My mom recalls me being...
For a little kid, it was like a professional voice.
And my dad says...
When did I learn that you could sing? When I sang with you when you were about 3 years old.
I've always asked myself, where do I get my singing from? This question sparked the battle of the worst. So I asked my parents, where do I get my singing from?
Of course, from me. As you can hear, I have a baritone, you know. My family, we have good voice.
I guess it's me, even though I don't know how to sing.
Why do you think it's you?
My siblings, they all can sing very well.
So you think I got it from your side?
Oh, yeah, because I hear my sisters sing, but they sing very well.
That was a clip of my aunt singing in our native Benin language. Growing up in a Nigerian culture, I learned that singing was a big part of monumental life events. I guess that's where I grew the desire to sing for any crowd I could get.
I'll think of you every step the way.
Before every major event, my dad would brag about how sweet his voice is.
This is a very, very sexy, you know, aspect of music, you know, when the voice is mellow.
And sometimes he would tell me how lucky I was to inherit his vocal genes. I asked my three siblings, who sounds better, mom or dad? My older sister Dahlia couldn't help but laugh.
Neither one of them can sing. Daddy's voice sounds horrible, and mommy's voice sounds horrible.
Whenever anyone asks about where we get our voices from, Daddy always boasts about it. My younger brothers, Michael and Isusa, they both believe that two wrongs surely can't make a vocal right.
Like, well, the way you sing and the way our parent, the way our parents sing, you think that you're adopted?
I don't think you got it for anyone, because one, mommy can't sing, and two, daddy can't sing at all. I think actually daddy's worse than mommy at singing.
I decided to sit with both my parents and ask them, who do they really think can sing better?
I think I'll be better than your dad.
I have always loved music, you know. She's my blood. You want to know if I can sing? Just look at my kids.
I thought, why not settle this battle here and now by having them sing a snippet of their favorite song?
He who that began the walk in you. Yeah, you see, my voice is better. I will sound better than what you're calling Moshe.
You know, people will pay $1 million to hear this. When I need love, I raise up my hands and I touch love.
No matter how bad or good my parents may be, I know that when it comes down to my turn to teach my children how to sing, I won't have a problem. I'll just keep singing. Amen, Oyeboke, Annenberg, Radio News.
Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
Sonic City!
My name is Howard, and we're on the Santa Monica Pier. Well, I put birds on people so they can take photos of themselves, and then I do tricks around them, throwing the bird over and over, backflipping, spinning her, throwing her on people when they're not looking. She's 3 years old. This one's 17. These two other two are 7 years old. They're all very friendly.
Community members in Filipino Town are celebrating a new addition to their neighborhood. JJ Maldonado has the story.
There were cheers and applause as Councilman Mitch O'Farrell made the honorary cut at the ribbon ceremony. He unveiled a concrete sign that read Historic Filipino Town, today in the area of Temple Street in downtown Los Angeles. Congressman Javier Becerra, who represents the downtown area, spoke with much pride for his district.
We're telling people in the Filipino-American community here in Los Angeles, you have a place. You belong.
Becerra took a few moments to thank Mayor Garcetti for securing a federal grant of $400,000 to install the new sign and clean up the neighborhood.
He worked very, very hard to get several hundred thousand dollars made available to this project so it could be completed. But I want to make sure that we acknowledge Mayor Garcetti for what he did to make this a reality.
New trash bins and trees were also added into the area. Many in the Filipino community see this as a giant step towards self-identification.
It's a marker, it's an identity for all Filipinos.
And I'm proud as a Filipino-American because we belong here.
Project manager Ryan Carpio partnered with Congressman Becerra to get the funds for the project.
Right. To see this through is one of those little gems that I'll forever treasure.
Historic Filipino Town dates back to the 40s, but with its new improvements, the community hope it is there for years to come. JJ Maldonado, Annenberg Radio News.
That's it for this Thursday. Our production assistant is Lexi McAvinci. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, and the newscast producer is Victor Figueroa. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Bryony Ng. We'll be right back.